Again, a second time. So it is good to be here. I was asked to speak on the topic of starlight. Is distant starlight a problem? This gave me an excuse to dig into some of the models that have been proposed by various creationists. So the bulk of my talk tonight will deal with this problem. So it'll be a bit more technical than last time when I spoke about worldviews. If we have time left, I'll spend a bit of time talking about Big Bang cosmology and some of the problems there as well. So if you look around you in the night sky, pictures of galaxies, and on this picture from the Hubble telescope, every piece of light you see there is a galaxy, thought to be very far away. And the question arises, if these galaxies are billions of light years away, how is that possible if the universe is only 6,000 years old? Because wouldn't have taken light billions of years to get here. So how can we solve that problem? This problem is one of a larger one in what we call cosmology. So cosmology deals with the science of the universe as a whole. So the object is to describe the universe and to explain why the universe is the way that it is. And to do that, we try to develop cosmological models. So a model, if you like, is a simplified view of reality. Usually it involves some mathematical equations, some physical principles. And then from that model, that mathematical model, we try to make various predictions and see how well it fits in with reality. But lately, there have been many recent advances in technology. So with Hubble's telescope and more recent ones, we have a huge amount of data. This data is causing many cosmological models to change. It turns out many predictions were wrong and have to be recast. So in particular, from our point of view, biblical cosmology has various goals. One might be to critique non-biblical cosmologies, such as Big Bang cosmology. So here we might look at problems that the Big Bang cosmology has, look for contradictions with observations. We might look at evidences that appear to show a young age rather than billions of years, and so on. So this is a negative aspect, if you like. More positively, biblical cosmology tries to set up an alternative model. So we try to explain reality within a biblical framework. And here, there's a number of problems that we're faced with. First of all is distant starlight. Okay, if the universe is so big, okay, how could light possibly get here in a short amount of time? There's other problems. How do we explain the redshifts that we observe in galaxies? How do we explain the background radiation? These last two are cited quite often as proofs for Big Bang cosmology. So if you want to come up with an alternative creationist model, then you should try to explain these as well. Then there's the problem also of structures. How do we explain the formation of galaxies, stars, and so on? So these are all different aspects of biblical cosmology, but the one I want to deal with specifically tonight is the first one there, distant starlight. And this is the one that most creationists have also spent the most amount of time on. So if we look at this, the main challenge, explaining distant starlight in a young universe, we'll find that there's a number of different strategies that you could use and that have been used. The first one is maybe the distances are wrong. Maybe space is curved instead of Euclidean or straight. A second possibility is that the speed of light was perhaps infinite at creation, and that it has since become less to what we now observe. A third possibility is that we have different clock rates. Okay, time dilation, that's called. So perhaps the clock on the Earth is ticking a lot slower than clocks on the galaxy. So that as the clocks on Earth tick 6,000 years, the clocks on distant galaxies might record billions of years. Another possibility is mature creation. Okay, perhaps God created the universe mature, fully formed, with the light rays en route. Maybe the light rays never actually came from stars or galaxies. Another possibility is that history is illusionary, that there's no real history. This is more of a model that has been put up by secular astronomers. Tipler, for example, has written a paper called How to Create a Falsifiable Theory in Which the Universe is Only 6,000 Years Old. So he's not a creationist, but he's come up with this model that says that if you want to be a creationist, here's a model that you could use, and you can't disprove it scientifically. And the last option that you could take is one of instrumentalism. With this option, we would say, well, the function of a scientific theory is not to tell us about things that we can't see, but just to help us to make predictions so that theories are just useful fictions, as it were. And we don't have to take them realistically. So since we can't observe the past, science has nothing to say about the past, and so there is no problem. So those are the various options that I'd like to look at tonight. The first one then deals with distances. How do we determine distances in astronomy? Well, the first step is to measure distances in the solar system. And the easiest way to do that is to use radar. So if you send a radar signal to a solid object, a planet, for example, and wait till it bounces back, and then if you have a sensitive receiver that can pick up the reflected signal, then by measuring the time delay and knowing that the radar signal travels at the speed of light, you can calculate what the distance is going to be. So if, for example, you look at Venus as it orbits around the sun, and if you keep finding distances using radar as it goes around its orbit, then the average distance would simply be the distance from us to the sun. And if you calculate that, you'll find that the average time delay in a radar signal from here to Venus and back is almost 1,000 seconds. So if the speed of light is about 300,000 kilometers per second, then you find the average distance, okay, the distance to the sun, where the astronomical unit, as we call it in astronomy, AU for short, is about 150,000 kilometers or 93,000 miles. So this is pretty straightforward, right? You just send a signal, wait for it to bounce back. We know what the speed of the signal is, or we think we do, and all we have to do is measure the time delay. Then once we have the distance to the sun, we try to get distances to the stars. And to do that, okay, so I've got the figures here. So to get the distance to the nearest stars, we use what we call parallax. Now, as the Earth orbits the sun, as you look at a star that's nearby, the position of that star with respect to stars that are far away, okay, the background stars, is going to change. So for example, in January, we look at the nearby star and it seems to be close to these stars here in the background. Whereas if you look at the stars in July, look at the same star, it seems to have shifted and now it's over there. So for example, if you look at the position of my head, if you move your head from side to side, you'll find that my head seems to move with respect to the background here. So parallax works exactly the same. So what you do then is you take two photographs, and you compare these two photographs, one in January, one in July, and then you measure the parallax angle. And then you can use trigonometry. So you've got a right triangle here. If you know this angle here, we know the distance to the sun. We've measured that by radar. So then using trigonometry, we can get this distance here, d. So if you do that, we find that the nearest star, okay, Proxima Centauri, has an angle of 0.772 seconds of arc. So the distance will be 1 over the tangent of that. And the tangent is roughly the same as the angle if you're using radians. So it's 1 over 0.772 seconds of arc. In astronomy, we call 1 over seconds of arc a parsec. So this works out to 1.3 parsec. And a parsec, 1 parsec is about 3.26 light years. So we find that the nearest star is about 4.24 light years away. Now, if you believe that Adam saw stars when he was created, okay, on day 6, then you already have a problem, because if this star is, if the nearest star is 4 light years away, and if stars were created just a couple of days before Adam, then if all the light comes from stars, then you've got a problem here, because Adam wouldn't see the first stars until 4 years later. Now, you can use this method. It's accurate to about 1,000 light years. Okay, with the latest telescopes, Hubble telescopes, and more recent ones, it's possible to get much more accurate parallaxes than before. Once you get further than 1,000 parsecs, okay, about 3,000 light years, you have to use other methods. And what you do is you find, use the parallax to find the distances to a large number of stars that are within 1,000 parsecs or light years. You find that some of these stars have special properties. For example, if you look at Cepheid, these are variable stars. The brightness of these stars varies. And it turns out that the period with which it varies depends on the intrinsic brightness. So if you can calculate the period of a Cepheid, then you can work out what its intrinsic brightness is. And then by looking at the actual brightness and calculating that the brightness falls off with the inverse square law. So if you move 10 times away from an object, it's going to appear 100 times as faint, because the way that light spreads out. So we use the inverse square law to estimate the distance using the observed brightness. So the formula for that is that the distance is 10 to the power of little m minus big M, where big M is the brightness the star would have if it were placed at 10 parsecs. M is the brightness that you actually observe. And then from this method, you can get distances that are billions of light years away. And if you're looking at galaxies, then you'll find there's a relationship between redshift and distance. So quite often, if you're looking at a galaxy that's far away, if you can calculate what the redshift is, then you can use that to estimate what the distance is. So this gets you distances up to about 13 billion light years. Now, you might ask, is there any way that this could be wrong? It looks pretty straightforward, right? We're just using a very simple trigonometric equation for the parallax. Well, it turns out that there are a number of ways that you could question this if you wanted to. But one of these is the following, that in using the parallax, you're assuming that the stars in the background are infinitely far away. Okay, what if that's not the case? What if the furthest star is actually only, let's say, 6,000 light years away? Then you'll find that those distances are going to be off, and you're going to have to change the formula. So again, you're going to have to use those two right angles. Okay, here's the original equation we had. We assumed that this star was infinitely far away, but if it's actually here at 6,000 light years, then we have to do a little bit of math. So if the most distant star is at distance d, then the measured parallax is going to be actually the difference between those two angles. So that means that the apparent distance is going to be much larger than what the actual distance is. So for example, if the furthest star is 6,000 light years away, and since on the photograph we just measure the relative parallax, okay, we just look at the difference between the star we see and the background stars, you'll find that it doesn't make any difference for stars that are close by. Okay, 100 light years is the actual, the apparent. If this most distant star is only 6,000 years away, it's only 101. If it's 1,000 light years away, that becomes 1,200. But you find if the actual most distant star is 6,000 light years away, and if your star is close to 6,000 light years away, then because you're just looking at the differences in angle, and because the difference will be zero, it will appear to be infinitely far away. So if the most distant stars are in fact only 6,000 light years away, then you'll find that the parallax method might be wrong, because it would give you wrong answers. Is there a way to check this? Well, it turns out there is, because if we know the actual size of an object in space, we could get its distance by measuring its angular size. How big does it appear to be from where we see it? Now, in 1987, a supernova was observed. A supernova is when a star explodes, and the brightness of a star increases very dramatically over a short period of time. Supernova 1987 was very interesting because it was observed to explode, so we could take measurements and photographs to see what would happen. And here on the right-hand side, you have a photograph of the supernova about a year, or 240 days after the explosion. The light from the explosion was found to hit a ring of material that was around the supernova. We could calculate the distance because it took 240 light days for the light to travel from the center to the ring. So that means that we know what this distance here is, 240 light days. And since we can measure this angle here, the angular size, if we measure that, then we find that the distance to supernova 1987A is 168,000 light years. So this is a check that the most distant stars can't be only 6,000 light years away. Now, there is another way, however, that you could challenge this if you wanted to. So far, we're assuming that space is normal. It's what we call Euclidean space. What if space is curved? Now, curved space is a bit of a tough notion to get across if you're not a mathematician. Let's look at this diagram here. So at the bottom here, we have what we call Euclidean space. This is two-dimensional. So in Euclidean space, note that with Euclidean space, all the lines of a triangle are straight. The angles are going to add up to 180 degrees. Now, if you were to draw that triangle on a sphere, so if you take a soccer ball and draw a triangle on it with straight lines, it would appear like this. And you'll find that if you measure those angles, they turn out to be more than 180 degrees. In fact, on a soccer ball, you could draw a right triangle that has three right angles on it. Right? Or take an orange, for example. You just cut it halfways, then the other way, make a few cuts, and you'll find that the angles add up to more than 180 degrees. And note that light travels here in curved lines rather than straight lines. In hyperbolic geometry, we get a similar sort of thing, but a different direction. Here you find if you draw a triangle on a hyperbolic surface, the angles become smaller, and you find the angles add up to less than 180 degrees. Note that the light travels in curved lines again, but this time it curves the other way. Now, if space was curved, what effect would that have on the distances of objects? So stars seem further than they are. So let's imagine that this is your actual galaxy, let's say, that you're looking at. If you have light coming from the galaxy in elliptic or spherical space, it's going to come in on curved lines. Note that it's curved here at the end. If you're sitting at the telescope looking at the star, it seems that the light is coming from here, because you're going to assume it travels in straight lines. So this object will appear to be here. So it appears to be a lot closer than it actually is. So if space was elliptical, stars seem closer than they are. That's not going to solve our problem, right? Because that means that stars are actually even further away than billions of light years. Now, what if light is curved the other way in elliptic hyperbolic space? In hyperbolic space, we find stars seem to be further away than they actually are. So now we have an object here. The light comes in, it's curved, but it's curved the other way. So if you're sitting here at the telescope, seeing the light come in, it seems to come from way out there. So an object that's actually close by will seem to be far away. So instead of being billions of light years away, the galaxy could actually be very close by in this kind of a model. So stars seem further away than they actually are. If they're moving away at the speed of light, okay, so here I'm taking into account that so there's a redshift there. The nearest objects or the most distant objects seem to be moving away from us at speed close to the speed of light. So that means that if we see an object now, it must have left that object 3,000 light years away, 3,000 years away. So if you look at the formula that we have, you can work it out mathematically. You find the apparent distance is r, where r is the radius of a curvature, is a constant, times the hyperbolic sine. I won't bore you with the explanations for that. These are exponential functions. But if you plug that into the formula, you'll find that for the nearest or for the furthest star, which is seems to be 12 billion light years away, if it's actually 3,000 light years away, that means you have to have a curvature of 160 light years. So if we look at the supernova, I've missed a slide here. Okay, the slide is, it's still coming. There it is. That's what I was looking for. So you find that you get this sort of a thing here. If the actual distance is, the space is curved, hyperbolic space, if the actual distance is 32 light years away, you don't get too much difference. Okay, in the parallax, you'll find you get 40 light years. If you look at the angular size, it's 32, or the magnitude. But you find once you get 160 light years, it starts to make an appreciable difference. And if a star is 1,600 light years away in curved space, then if you look at the angular size of it, it seems to be about 2 million light years away. If you look at the relative parallax, it seems to be 38 billion light years away. So if space is hyperbolic, what I'm saying is that you would get very large apparent distances both with parallax and with apparent magnitude. The thing, however, is that they're different. So you could test this theory by looking at the different distances that you would get from these two to see if, in fact, these are going to compare or not. So it's a testable theory. But if you wanted to, this is one way that you could proceed to solve the distant starlight problem. Note that it doesn't solve the problem of how Adam saw stars on day 6. He still has to wait for 4 light years to see the first star. So Adam would still see the first star 4 years after creation. And you would need mature creation for stars and galaxies. How do you explain how the stars and galaxies got there in the first place? Well, you haven't got time for them to form, so God would have had to create them instantaneously. So this is the first possibility. Now, the next one is the decreasing speed of light. Barry Satterfield came up with this back in the 1980s. So he argued that light was infinitely fast at creation. After that, it decays exponentially. There's some evidence for that. If you look at measurements of the speed of light over the last 300 years, okay, the first measurement was taken in the late 1600s. It was up here, then it seems to be decreasing. The trouble is that just when the measurements get to be very precise, it seems to have stopped, okay, which is unfortunate, perhaps suspicious, because here, although you get a decrease, you have huge error bars. There's large uncertainties that are happening here. Not only that, but you find that if the speed of light changes, you're going to get other changes as well. If energy is conserved, then the energy of a photon, light particle, is given by h, which is Boltzmann's constant, times the speed of light divided by the wavelength. So if the wavelength is constant, you'll get this formula here, which means that Boltzmann's constant also has to change. So you can't just have the speed of light changing by itself. It has certain implications. And you'll find Maxwell's equations deal with electricity and magnetism. With Maxwell's equations, the speed of light is equal to one of the square roots of these two quantities here, which have to do, okay, these are permittivity, they have to do with how electricity and magnetism are conducted through space. So you find that if the speed of light changes, the electromagnetic changes equations have to change, which means that your clock rates, radioactive decay rates, are also changing in proportional to C. So this is a benefit here, because if the radioactive rates were initially very fast and have slowed down, that could also explain why some rocks might be dated at billions of years. These changes are explained using, this is where it gets complicated, because to explain those changes, he has what he calls a zero-point energy field. So he explains this with quantum energy in a vacuum. Using this and plasma physics, he explains the rapid formation of planets, stars, and galaxies. It's a very sophisticated theory. It has been critiqued by a number of creationists. For example, there's no recent measure change in any of these, in the speed of lights, or Boltzmann's constant, or the mass of the electron, for example. It's highly speculative. John Hartnett, a creationist cosmology, claims it's ruled out by a pulsar, where we can measure the change in period, which depends on the speed of light. So he claims that shows the speed of light hasn't changed at all over the last 1,000 years or so. But Satterfield has a rebuttal for that, because Hartfield, in his analysis, implicitly assumes that the speed of light is constant. So it depends how you analyze the observations. Alternatively, you could say, well, maybe C, the speed of light varies with position. So maybe the speed of light is very fast once you're far away from an object, and it slows down once you get close to an object. You could get the suitable math for this to work out, but why would it do that physically? To explain it physically, plausibly, is difficult. A lot of these explanations you'll find are what we call ad hoc. They're sort of invented or constructed to save the thing in question, but they don't have an independent cause. Most creationists don't agree with Satterfield. He seems to be alone on working on this model, although it has very interesting properties. So a more popular model has to do with time dilation. Perhaps the clock on the Earth is running much slower than clocks on distant galaxies. Could this be the case? Well, you can get time dilation a number of different ways. For example, if an object is moving away from you, it appears to move slower because as it sends back a signal, each time it sends back a signal, it's moved further away. So it takes longer for the signal to get to you. So even if the clock was running at the same speed on the rocket as here, it would still appear to run slower if it's moving away from you. it would appear to run faster if it's moving towards you. In special relativity, if his clock is moving through space, it will itself tick slower. And in cosmological expansion, if the universe is expanding in Big Bang cosmology, then clocks that are embedded in space will also appear to tick slower. But the trouble with these is that they're the wrong way, because if the Earth is fixed at the center and if things are moving away from it, we want things to speed up on those other clocks, but instead they appear to slow down. So it gives you time dilation in the opposite sense. And you'll find that the difference is too small to account for the billions of years. So instead, the type of time dilation that's looked at is gravitational time dilation. If you have a clock that's running close to a gravitational field, that clock will appear to tick slower, unless it's a grandfather pendulum clock. It depends on gravity, but if it's any other type of clock, you'll find it ticks slower. So if you have a strong gravitational force at the edge of the galaxy or at the edge of the universe, that could cause the observed redshifts, but it would cause the clocks far away to slow down, which is not what you want. So what you need instead is a strong gravitational source near the Earth, okay, which we presently don't observe. So then you have to postulate that was there in the past. Gravity doesn't affect clocks in the homogeneous universe or in free fall in any other type of universe, so you need rather special conditions. A number of these cosmologies have been constructed. Russell Humphreys in 1994 wrote a book called Starlight and Time. Here he says that the Earth is near the center of an expanding universe, which is bounded, doesn't go infinitely far. So it's like an explosion, if you like, centered at the Earth. So he claims that relativistic gravitational time dilation slows the Earth clocks. The problem is that it's hard to get enough time dilation. If you do get it, you would expect to get a blue shift in distant galaxies, whereas instead we see a red shift. A number of people, including myself, have critiqued this model as saying that it doesn't give you time dilation at the Earth. And now Humphreys agrees. In 2008, he says that, in fact, his model doesn't give enough time dilation for nearby stars and galaxies, and that the equations are too complex to analyze. So Humphreys agrees now that this first model doesn't work, so he's come up with a second model more recently. And in this model, here's a picture of it. He claims that the universe is bounded, so it's like a ball, if you like, a solid ball. Outside the universe, we have the waters above. So this is from Genesis 1, where God separated the waters below the expanse from the waters above. So he claims that there's a huge shell about the universe, which weighs about 20 times the mass of the universe. And he claims that in this model, the Earth clocks will stop while the galaxies age billions of years. And the equation that you get for the ticking of a clock is this equation here. So what happens is that if this number here is equal to 1, then you find this time goes to 0 here and your clock will stop. And in fact, Humphreys claims that if this number here is greater than 1, then we have the square root of a negative number, which is an imaginary number, but he claims that if the number is imaginary, then the time is still 0. So he claims then that what happens at creation is that the universe is in a timeless zone, galaxies are formed, the Earth stays in the timeless zone, and then eventually everything emerges from the timeless zone. And then at the flood, you have another timeless zone. So he has to explain here why. So he claims that as this shell moves, okay, it hits a certain position where the clocks inside will stop. Okay, it stays in that position while galaxies are being formed. And then it moves out again. And at the time of the flood, it stops again. So you get a time zone for a second time, and then it continues expanding. He has to make a number of assumptions. First of all, he has a new solution to general relativity. Yeah, nobody else accepts that solution. Also, it's a well-known fact in astronomy mechanics that if you have a hollow shell, that inside that you won't get any gravitational forces. Forces will cancel out. So the question is, how come he gets a difference in potential and force at the Earth and at the galaxies? Because the galaxies are also inside the shell, because the waters above the universe are outside the entire universe. So he has something here that's contrary to what's called Birkhoff's theorem, that if you have a hollow shell, you shouldn't have any forces inside, and all clocks inside should move at the same time. He also says that imaginary time is the same as zero time, okay, which is usually in physics, if you have an equation where you have the square root of minus one, that means that your equations don't work. They break down in that region. So the problems are that if the potential is constant inside the shell, if time stops at the Earth, it should stop everywhere else. He claims that perturbations due to galaxy creation drive relative time dilation, so that's going to change the rates of the clock, but he doesn't spell out clearly how that's going to happen. So he doesn't give any detailed calculations. In 2013, Humphreys noted that his model, which came out in 2008, is far from being complete, but as yet he has published no updates really in the last 7 years. So this model, if it's going to work, it needs a lot of work, and I'm skeptical of it. There's a third model, time dilation, put out by John Hartnett in 2007. He's got a book called Starlight, Time, and the New Physics. So in this, he uses the cosmology of an Israeli physicist by the name of Kermeli, who extended general relativity to apply to a five-dimensional cosmology. So he has the Earth near the center. Time dilation is cosmic expansion of space. So you get this long equation here. Usually in general relativity, you get this equation except for the first term on the right-hand side here. So Kermeli has added that term in here. And Hartnett claims that this solves the problem of distant starlight, that only a few days would elapse at the Earth while billions of years elapse on galaxies. The trouble with his model is that he uses novel physics because nobody else has used Kermeli's cosmology. Kermeli himself has died a few years ago, so he's not working on it anymore either. So Hartnett's own assessment, written a few months ago, regarding his theory is that he writes it has a new dimension, the expansion velocity of the universe. What that exactly is, I don't really understand. This cosmology still has several unsolved problems. Unfortunately, no general five-dimensional cosmology exists. Kermeli never found such a solution. To date, I have not found the required space-time velocity theory with an extra time-like dimension that fits the creation. So I'm continuing to search. Again, he published this in 2007. Now, 8 years later, he really hasn't come up with anything else to back it up. And in fact, in the same paper where he discusses the model, he also writes that he prefers the model by Jason Lyell. So, to summarize so far, the slow Earth clocks, these models usually involve novel physics, miraculous spurts of expansion of the universe, they're ad hoc. They have not been worked out in detail. Humphrey's model needs a strong geocentric universe with the Earth near the bottom of a sharp gravitational well. But Hartnett and Humphrey's, they both oppose geocentricity, okay, the notion that the Earth is at the center of the universe. Instead, they say that the galaxy is near the center of the universe. But that means that the galaxy has to be created mature, and that he still has the distance light starlight problem for stars inside the galaxies, which means up to about 30,000 light years. Now, if you're going to postulate a slow Earth clock, it's much easier just to say, well, in the Bible, time is defined by the day. So if the rotation of the Earth was very slow on day four, so it took billions of years, okay, that would solve the problem. Then you'd have one Earth day in billions of years. So that would be a much simpler solution. The trouble with that is that you have gravitation created on day three. How could that last a billion of years, a billion of night time as well? And on day six, Genesis 2 verse 5 says that this vegetation had not yet sprouted. So that's one difficulty you would have with that type of a solution. Or you could argue perhaps the Earth was enclosed in a miraculous time bubble during day four, so that elsewhere the universe clocks ticked billions of years. It was on the Earth, it just ticked for 24 hours. Now, there is another model by Jason Lyle, which he has been promoted recently, 2010 particularly. He writes that special relativity assumes that the speed of light is the same in all directions. But if you try to measure the speed of light, then you'll find that you can only measure the speed of light bouncing light to an object and then back. Just like the radar beams to Venus and back, okay? We can measure the time delay back and fro, but you can't measure it one way because then you need two clocks. And how do you know that this clock here reads the same time as that clock there? To set that time, you'll find that you have to assume the speed of light is constant both ways. So it's a problem that you can't prove it with special relativity. So Einstein assumed the speed of light was the same both ways, whereas Lyle says, why don't we assume that the speed of light is infinitely fast towards us, towards the Earth, and moving away from it, it's half the normal speed. Then if you go away from the Earth and back and take the average, then you get the speed of light same as before. So that seems to solve the problem quite neatly, right? If the speed of light was infinitely fast away from stars, then even if they're billions of light years away, you would see them instantaneously. An atom would see them on the day he was created, because the light would be there already. So we assume here, it's the anisotropic light speed convention, that when a distant galaxy is created, light comes from instantaneously so that we see it at the Earth immediately. Now, there's two ways, however, of interpreting this. Does the light really travel infinitely fast? Or is it just a convention that we agree to set the clocks in such a way that it works out? So is it just a convention? Then it's just the language of appearance. So for example, I could say that I came here, I traveled from Amsterdam to Seattle instantaneously, because when I left the airport in Amsterdam, it was 12 o'clock noon. And when I came here in Seattle, it was 12 o'clock noon, same day. So I came here instantaneously. Of course, going back is going to take me 20 hours. All right, so on the average, it's 10 hours. So this is one way of interpreting it. So in the ACS, the anisotropic speed convention, we define an event to occur when we see it. So we adjust the clocks along the light path so that they all read the same time when the clock passes them. So light made on day four on clock G on the distant galaxies arrives here on day four as well. But you could also interpret it in Einstein's convention. And if you do that, then you'll find that galaxies were created billions of years ago successively in shells, so that all the light comes here all at once on day four. So using this convention then, when God said he created the stars on day four, actually he created them billions of years ago, but the light just came here all at once on day four altogether. So both are equally valid. The problem with this is that Genesis 1, God says, let there be light, and there was light. seems to talk about it being darkness before. Then there was light, not just that it seems to be light, but there was light. Genesis 1:16, God made the stars and set them in the expanse to give light on the earth, but the expanse wasn't made till day two. So we can't interpret this to say that God really made the stars earlier and that they just appeared on day four. In Exodus 20, we read, in 6 days God made heaven, the earth, and all that is in them. So again, that seems to point to the fact that the stars are actually made on day six and not that they just appear. So these texts entail that galaxies were not created before day one, light, and day two, the expanse, which is space. So this works only if days one and two really lasted billions of years. And if you're going to go in this direction, if stars only became visible from the Earth on day four, why not simply postulate that the Earth had a thick atmosphere, which cleared on day four? Then you have exactly the same effects, which is basically the position of Hugh Ross. So I'm not convinced that this method really works. What about the other possibility? Here, light really moves at infinite speed towards the Earth. So all galaxies were created mature on day four. The problem with this is that it's implausible. Why should light, the speed of light, depend on direction to the Earth? Is it testable? A lot of physicists claim it's not testable, which seems surprising. I think if you stick to special relativity, it may not be testable, but if you use general relativity and other methods, somehow I think it should be testable. For example, neutrinos are very light objects that move almost as fast as the speed of light. These were observed to come from supernova 1987, about the same time as the light did. So if light travels infinitely fast, that means neutrinos have to move infinitely fast as well. And don't they have mass? What about conservation of energy? Does that switch as they bounce off the Earth and go back into space? What about charged particles in a cyclotron? These are going at almost the speed of light as well. It seems to me that you've got big problems there, and I really don't see this working. This is just something you could use to test the speed of light. You send a ray through one. You have two disks with slots in them, and depending upon the speed at which they're going, you should be able to measure when a photon goes through a slot, either one way or the other. So the problem here is that it doesn't sound very plausible. The Croatian Ministries International is very skeptical of this. Jason Lyle is working for Answers in Genesis, I think, or the Croatian Research Society. Sarfati, for example, claims that a constant C makes physical sense with electromagnetic equations and so on, that it lacks, Lyell's model lacks a physical foundation, it's ad hoc. CMI prefers time dilation models like those of Humphreys and Hartnett, but we just see that there's problems with those as well. And although they prefer Hartnett's model, Hartnett prefers Lyell to his own model. So the summary so far is that we've got curved space as a possibility. It's testable. We've got C decay, speed of light decaying. It's very complex. The white hole cosmology of Humphreys has been abandoned. He's got the timeless zone one, but that's incomplete. A time bubble, I don't think anybody takes that seriously. Hartnett's 5D model, I think it's pretty well abandoned by Hartnett. The Lyell convention, I don't know if it's testable, okay, but it seems to be implausible. Note that all of these involve mature creation to some degree. So the question is, if you need mature creation anyways, why not use mature creation for the whole universe as such? That would be the simplest model. So most of the previous cosmology still needs some degree of mature creation, because even if you could get these clocks to slow down at the Earth, the clocks at the sun would run the same rate at the Earth for the nearby stars as well, so it's not going to solve that problem. So why not simply postulate mature creation for the entire universe? Now, Hartnett, Lyell, Sarfati, and others reject the notion of light created en route, since this gives a fictional history, because they argue then the supernova 1987 never really happened. They argue that God is not deceived, but has given us reliable senses, so what we see should refer to an actual history, so that the light from supernova 1987 really refers to an explosion and was not created. It's not a fictional account of history. But here we have to remember that the stars and their light rays need to be in mature form only at the end of day four. Creation may involve miracles, so it may involve speeded up processes. For example, think of Jonah's find. Jonah was sitting in the hot sun, is complaining about the heat, so God grew a special vine which grew overnight to give him shade. So why couldn't God have done the same thing in creation, that he used speeded up processes? Because in creation, you find God doesn't create things from nothing. Okay, originally, there's the waters. Okay, but from the waters, they're separated. We get the dry land. Then we get the animals coming from the ground. Adam was made from dust, remember? So there's a process. So perhaps God used the process also to create stars and galaxies very quickly, so that the light that we see from them actually came from these stars, but it moved very fast during the first week of creation. And after that, after the week of creation was finished, it moved at its normal speed. Danny Faulkner is one that has promoted this recently, and I think it has a lot of merit. I'm running out of time here. So for example, if you think of the galaxies created instantaneously, that does mean that it's created with its light and everything that you see, but that means that each light ray has a fictional history in it. So it seems that with any mature creation, you can't escape the notion of either a fictional history or a very speeded up process which covers it. Some scientists have said that if you believe in mature creation, there's no way that you can disprove it. A benevolent God could easily arrange creation so that the super radiation was traveling towards us from the edge of the universe. It would be impossible for any scientist to refute it. All they could do would be to disagree with the author's cosmological premises. So mature creation is a hypothesis that scientifically you can't falsify. Physicist Herbal Dingell says much the same thing. But the question, would God deceive us, is one that occurs quite frequently. Don Stoner, an old Earth creationist, has written, either God's creation testifies that it is much older than 10,000 years, or God has deceived us in his creation. A few things to note here. First of all, the history of an object cannot be directly deduced, but it depends on various assumptions, okay, usually naturalist assumptions, about past processes and events. Those assumptions could be mistaken. So maybe Stoner is deceiving himself rather than God deceiving him. Secondly, Stoner does not consider the converse. If God is not deceived, then shouldn't we accept his testimony that the Lord said, in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth? Because if God doesn't deceive, then certainly we should take him at his word. It's interesting that the notion that God wouldn't deceive us is one that's very commonly used to justify all sorts of things. The famous philosopher Descartes, founder of modern rationalism, if you like, he refers to God quite often for his defense. In his book, Meditations on First Philosophy, he writes, God is perfect, hence God cannot deceive. So God would not permit me to be deceived concerning the truth of those propositions that seem entirely clear to me. Hence, those propositions must be true. An interesting argument. Would God deceive us? Well, note that scripture does say that God cannot lie, but these remarks always occur in an explicitly covenantal context, meaning that God cannot lie to believers because he has promised not to. God is faithful to us, so we can take him at his word. But scripture specifically says that God does deceive those who are not believers. Some interesting texts here. Look at 2 Thessalonians. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false, in order that all may be condemned who did not believe the truth. So God, though God himself may not deceive, God lets people deceive themselves, or he lets them be deceived by Satan. Ultimately, all religious deception is traceable to Satan, the serpent of old, who deceives the whole world. So the deception argument has some interesting things to note here in response to that. Maybe history is illusionary. Cosmologist Frank Tipler has written, it's thought to be it's impossible to construct a fossil fiber theory consistent with the thousands of observations indicating an age of billions of years, but which holds that the universe is only a few thousand years old. I consider such a view to be a slur on the ingenuity of theoretical physicists. We can construct a falsifiable theory with any characteristics you care to claim. He's not a Christian, and he certainly doesn't believe this model, but he's come up with a model. He's got an interesting paper here where he believes there's black holes that give you an illusionary history. So you would have a creationist model here, which satisfies all kinds of scientific criteria. Now, there's a famous statement, philosophy of science by Duhem Quine, which says that any statement can be held true, come what may, if we make drastic enough adjustments elsewhere in the system. So if you want to believe in naturalism, you can always get your theories to fit. If you believe in biblical cosmology, you can always get theories to fit that as well. It all depends what your priorities are. It's interesting that naturalism has its own problems with illusionary history. For example, if humans evolve from matter, then our brains are controlled by physical laws. So all our beliefs are illusions. I talked about this last time, about worldviews. So Francis Crick has written in his book, Astonishing Hypothesis, that astonishing hypothesis is that all your thoughts, your beliefs, and so on, are just illusions caused by brain neurons. Now, if that's true, then your belief in evolutionary history is also an illusion. Or quantum mechanics. Just a couple of months ago in May, the physicist Andrew Truscott wrote that the quantum level reality does not exist if you're not looking at it. So there was a recent experiment that seems to show that consciousness creates reality. And he writes, interesting enough, we all have fun ridiculing the creationists who think that the world sprang into existence on October 23rd, 4004 BC. Light from distant stars heading towards, etc. But if we accept the usual picture of quantum mechanics, then in a certain sense, the situation is far worse. The world as you experience it might not as well have existed a fraction of a second ago. Or a third example, is reality a simulation? Many cosmologists believe in the multiverse. Because life is so small or so hard to produce here, to explain the existence of life, they say, well, there's a multiverse, which means that any possible universe exists. Well, if that's the case, if all possible universe exists, that some must have advanced civilizations that can construct their own universe through a simulation, like the movie The Matrix. I don't know if you've watched that. If these advanced civilizations can create universes, then the chances are that those fake universes will be more plentiful than real universes, so that the chances are strong that right now you're actually living in a fake universe, which means that the history you think existed didn't really exist. You're just part of a simulation. So all interesting results of illusions that you end up with if you don't believe biblical reality. If you try to establish your own reality, you end up with all kinds of contradictions. The last possibility I mentioned was instrumentalism. This came up with Copernicus' work. At the forefront of his book, or his editor, that the model he's presenting wasn't necessarily a realistic model, but it was just meant to be useful for predictions. So this raises the question, is a model a useful fiction, or does it represent reality? Plato argued that theories are just mathematical models that say the hypothesis, they don't have to be physically true. His student, Aristotle, argued that theories should conform to reality. So this question of whether theories are real or just useful fictions has been around since about 400 BC. Ptolemy argued that theories are just useful for predictions. Hawking, who has written against Christianity, has argued he's proven God doesn't exist. Interestingly enough, in his book, The Grand Design, he writes, he defends what he calls model-dependent realism. It's pointless to ask whether a model is real, only whether it agrees with observation. If there are two models that both agree with observation, then one cannot say that one is more real than another. One can use whichever model is more convenient in the situation under consideration. So basically what he's saying here is that if you have a creationist model, you can't say that evolutionary model is more real than the creationist one. It's just which one's more convenient to use. So in the end, he ends up sort of defeating himself. Gordon Clark, a Christian philosopher, has argued that scientific theories are useful but never true. So is scientific history real or useful fiction? Dr. Adrian Keister recently wrote, he says, since science is based on the inductive method, which is a fallacy, okay, the inductive method basically says that the laws of physics that we observe here and now are always valid in the future, in the past, everywhere. So it rules out miracles, for examples. But how can you prove it? Well, you can't, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know what's happened before. So he argues that since science is based on that, it can only make probabilistic statements. Science can never arrive at the truth. So questions about origins are not within the domain of science. There are no repeatable experiments to reproduce what actually happened. Therefore, science simply cannot contradict the Bible. The Bible says something about origins, and science cannot. So that's another easy way. Okay. So this was the last method I was going to talk about, and I'm running out of time here. So unfortunately, we never got to Big Bang cosmology. I'm going to just briefly summarize this. So basically, what I want to say here is that I've spoken tonight about creationist models in cosmology. The advantages of these models are that they're based on biblical truth. The goal is to show that there's no contradiction between what we see and what the Bible tells us. It's always possible to find models that will fit the observations. The limits are that many biblical models are possible. So which one is true? We don't know. There are many possible possibilities, but I don't think that we should just limit ourselves to one. I think we should keep that in mind, that we really cannot go beyond what the Bible says. We can speculate how things may have happened, but we should be careful not to place our models above the Bible. So note that mature creation will solve these problems, but it doesn't explain why things are the way they are. It leaves that as an unanswered question. Also, it has limited apologetic value. Okay, because the assessments, how people look at models and assess them, ultimately depends upon what their worldview is. So if you're going to defend this model to an unbeliever, he'll laugh at you. ultimately, it's a question of worldviews. Just like I said in that little clip before I started, right? Everybody is biased, so we may as well put our biases in the forefront and work with those and show that we can come up with models that fit our biases. And we have to be careful here not to tie your belief in the Bible to any particular creationist model. Okay, we accept the truth of the Bible as a basic given, because God is faithful, God is truth. If we tie our faith in the Bible to a model, then once the model is defeated, your faith in the Bible may go with it. So we have to make sure that we don't put our thoughts on the level of those of God. Thank you very much. I'm going to end here.